short sword. Just the thing, just the thing indeed. I've heard about you, Corin. You're sparring with the weapons master. Heard you have incredible skill with a bow. If you'll be fighting, it will either be with a bow at long range, or sword for short quarters. In close combat, a short sword is both faster and less clumsy than a broadsword. Leave the big showy metal to knight cavalry, and to the idiot sons of royalty, so they can play at being soldiers. When your life is at stake, you want to move quickly. Slash and stab. Slash and stab. No room for a long sword in close combat. You get unlucky, and the tip gets caught on something. The next eye blink, you're looking at your guts spilled out onto the ground. Hedimer saw Corin's face go white at that thought. He'd forgotten how young the boy was. The dwarf coughed, and sipped tea while Corin stared into the fire for a moment, nervously slurping tea from his own cup. Ah, if you're ever in trouble, you'll have the master wizard by your side, eh? Let's go find you a sword. Hedimer led the way into a room that was filled with weapons, both finished and in rough form. The dwarf selected a half dozen finished blades, thought a minute, and unlocked a cabinet to get out another blade, then carried them through yet another door, which opened into a long, narrow corridor, at the end of which was a door to a well-equipped blacksmith shop. Hedimer walked through, shouting greetings and orders to several dwarf blacksmiths over the din of forges, bellows, pounding hammers, the hissing of hot metal being quenched in barrels of oil. Coming from the hot, closed air of the shop into the open courtyard was a shock. The cold winter air actually felt good. Try these swords. Feel the balance. Swing them around. If you find one that's close to what you want, I'll send for more of that type. And we can always modify a sword, or make a new one for you. Corin didn't need Hedimer's shop to change anything for him. The fourth sword he picked up was the one. As soon as he picked it up, he knew. It simply felt right in his hand, like it was a part of him. He was pretty sure this was the blade Hedimer had taken from the locked cabinet, whatever that meant. "You're sure, then?" Hedimer asked, almost disappointed that he wouldn't be creating a custom sword for the wizard servant. "I'm sure, sir. Like it was made for me. It's perfect." "Huh. Let's see how you use it." Hedimer strapped a blunt brass covering over Corin's sword, and picked up a practice axe. They began sparring, slowly at first. Corin had never sparred against a battle axe, nor against any opponent shorter than he was. Shorter, but also stronger. Instead of using the proper forms and techniques, because Corin didn't know the proper technique for defending against an axe, he had to fall back on his speed and instinct, or he'd be falling on his behind in the dirt. The weapons master, Corin decided, needed to teach axe fighting, and fighting against shorter enemies. Orcs were short in stature like dwarves, weren't they? And fought with axes. On his third time being knocked to the ground, Hedimer held up a hand in surrender. "Ah, if I still had a beard, I'd have to shave it off in shame, young Corin. With your speed, I'd wager you could beat me or most anyone with that sword. Or with a feather." The dwarf grumbled under his breath. Corin was sore, and his arms felt ready to fall off. "I was lucky, sir. I've never fought an axe or a dwarf." He swung his right shoulder around slowly to loosen it. "You're very strong, sir." "Bless you for taking it easy on an old dwarf's ego. I'll be sore in the morning, I wager." "That's the sword for you. No question about it. I'll have it sharpened, and we'll deliver it to the wizard's tower tomorrow. What about the grip?" It was plain, rough, brown leather.
I can make it nice. Inscribe your name on it.
Corin shook his head. He wasn't buying the sword. The money would come from the wizard's pockets. The sword would be Corin's to use while he served the wizard, but it would not be his property, any more than the brooms, mops, or other tools around the tower.
No, sir. It is fine the way it is. Thank you, sir. This is a fine blade.
None finer. Hedimer beamed with pride as he held the sword up and sighted down its length.
People think the strength of our metal comes from the way we work the metal in our forges, or the mixture of oil we use in the quench, or the quality of the ores we mine up in the mountains. The truth is, it's all that combined, plus more. He winked. And that's all I'll say about it now. Give my regards to the wizard, please.
The Lady Carlana Trehaim, regent of Tarador and mother of the Crown Princess, closed the heavy accounts book with a loud thump and rubbed her tired eyes.
Enough of these accounts for tonight. I am weary of keeping track of grain storage.
Forgive me, Your Highness,
Chancellor Calron interrupted gently.
We must...
Enough! Carlana fairly shouted, and emphatically slapped the leather cover of the accounts book. She picked up her half-empty wine glass and drained it in one long drink, then waved away the servant who was coming to refill the glass.
Yes, we need to look at this, but not tonight. Not tonight. Tomorrow morning.
Then we can look at this again,
after I have breakfast, and perhaps arrive into the countryside.
The wizard promised the weather would be better tomorrow.
These cloudy, chilly days have me down. I do so need a ride.
Calron rose from his chair, gathered up his books and scrolls, and bowed slightly to the regent.
Certainly, Your Highness.
He would be up late again, reviewing the royal accounts by himself. Only royalty could decide when they wanted to work or not. The rest of the world worked when they had to, which was all the time.
I shall wait upon you in the morning.
Wait, Chancellor, before you go, how is my daughter able to maintain her personal guard in the Thralrin?
I received a report from my captain there. She absent-mindedly searched for the particular scroll amongst the disorderly pile on her table before giving up.
And her troops are still there, with no sign they are preparing to leave any time soon. In fact, the commander of her guard ordered new pack mules. Surely she has run out of money by now.
Carlana had expected her daughter to raise the subject and apologize, but the princess had not mentioned it once.
Oh, that.
Calron had been dreading this question from the regent.
Your daughter has been able to obtain a loan from a merchant banker. A substantial loan. She will be able to fund her personal guard until she becomes queen.
My daughter dealt with a banker?
When?
How did she...
Her eyes narrowed.
She didn't. You did, didn't you?
Not personally. I had it handled with extreme discretion. The banking house does not know the loan was to your daughter.
Those tight-fisted merchants don't loan money to strangers. What did you do?
She asked suspiciously. The Chancellor felt like a fish on the end of a hook, dangling in front of the regent.
The princess gave me an emerald ring to use as surety for the loan. The merchant was led to believe the loan is to an unnamed baroness. Your daughter said she rarely wore this ring, so it is unlikely to be recognized.
Carlana didn't know whether to be angry, proud, or amused.
I know that ring. It's ugly. It's been in the family for years, but I don't think anyone has ever liked it.
She smiled, with only one side of her mouth.
My daughter has outmaneuvered me. I suppose I should be proud.
She is a very determined young woman, Your Highness, and clever.
Determined and clever may also be viewed as stubborn and sneaky, Chancellor. It does not help that my Chancellor went behind my back.
Please understand, I am in a very difficult position, Your Highness. Legally, I am your daughter's Chancellor, and I am responsible to her for personal matters. This did not affect state funds or property, and your daughter ordered me not to tell you.
Don't make this a habit, Chancellor.
Corrin stored his tools in a closet on the second level of the wizard's tower. It was a cramped, dark room with no window. He was putting his tools back one day after cleaning up after one of the wizard's explosive potion experiments, when he knocked a chisel off the shelf. It struck the floor, cutting a chip out of the stone. Corrin wasn't concerned about damage to the floor. It was already scarred from centuries of hard use. He picked up the chisel, the same chisel he had used to break the iron gate in his failed search for the cornerstone. The chisel was unharmed by its fall. He was about to place it back on the shelf when the deep scratch in the floor caught his eye. Getting down on his knees, Corrin inspected the mark the chisel had made in the stone floor. It looked familiar. Without thinking what he was doing, he picked up a hammer and used the chisel to make the gouge in the stone longer.
"Son of a," he exclaimed.
The marks by the chisel looked exactly like the scrape marks in the floor of the cornerstone chamber. Everyone assumed the marks had been caused by the enemy dragging the cornerstone across the floor. But if those marks had been made by a chisel, the enemy must have carved the marks to make the people of Tarador think the cornerstone had been hauled away. The scrolls Corrin had read all said those scrape marks proved the cornerstone had been dragged off its platform and across the floor. Could he be the first person to see the truth? But if the cornerstone had not been dragged away, what had happened to it?
"Ho, young Master Bladewell, are you ready?"
the weapons master asked as he wiped down the sword he had been using to spar against one of the royal brats he had to train, or had to waste his time with, since most of them were not serious about learning weaponscraft. His time with Corrin was, by contrast, pure delight, for the wizard's servant was diligent and never complained. And, having never used weapons other than a bow before, Corrin had no bad habits the weapons master needed to correct.
"Yes, sir. I have a new sword, sir. Pedras bought it for me to use." "The wizard bought it for you," the man said with a frown. "A soldier should choose his own weapons."
"Oh, I did, sir. I chose this blade. I should say that Pedras paid for it. Hedimer..."
"Hedimer? You have a dwarfish blade?
Give it here, let me see,"
the man demanded eagerly.
Yes, a fine blade."
He cut the air with it and tested its balance.
"A fine blade indeed. I don't have such a blade. This is true dwarfish make, not one of the human-made blades the dwarves only finish. This comes from the forges of Khazad itself."
He sighted down the blade suspiciously and tested the sharpness of the edge by lightly running it along one of the thick, heavy leather armor vests that hung on the wall of the weapons storeroom. Even with very light pressure, the blade sliced right through the leather,
as if it were passing through water.
The weapons master whistled admiringly. "Corin, try something for me," he asked, as he handed the sword back to the boy. "Test the edge by running your thumb along it. Carefully. Go lightly."
Corin did as he was asked, and was disappointed to feel the edge was dull.
"Sir, I'm sorry. I only got this blade 2 days ago. I don't know why it isn't sharp," he said with shame.
A soldier cares for his weapons. He should have honed it that morning.
"Ha! It is sharp!"
The weapons master held up the sliced open vest to demonstrate.
"That you have there is a magic spelled blade. Dwarvish magic. It can't cut you, and it will almost never go dull, so don't you bother trying to sharpen it."
"Pedrus himself has such a blade, yes. Him and the old king, Ariana's father. Our wizard paid a handsome sum for a blade like that, I reckon. Don't you let anyone monkey with that blade. They'd slice themselves open to the bone before they knew it. Now, let's put a brass guard on your new blade and see how you use it."
"Yes, sir,"
Corin said, while gazing in awe at his sword. Neither Hedimer nor Pedrus had mentioned anything special about the blade.
Sir, could you teach me to fight against an axe?"
"Hedimer thumped you good, then," the weapons master smiled. "All right. It's time you learn to fight against our foul orc enemy." "Hello, Kyr,"
Corin shouted across the courtyard, waving at his friend. Kyr was still sore from his own sparring session with the weapons master the day before, and in a foul mood. It was late, and the early spring night was cold. He wanted to hurry across the courtyard and relax in front of a warm fire, not waste time chatting with the wizard's servant. And Niles Fawn had again scolded Kyr for going out riding with Corin, rather than attending to his duties. Riding horses with the wizard's servant was one of the few times in a week that Kyr could relax and forget about rank and protocol for a while, for Corin knew nothing about either.
"Corin, when we're in public, it is proper for you to call me Your Grace. I'm not a kitchen servant you can shout at."
Fawn's suggestion that Kyr was not loyal to his father had stung him, and Kyr had been avoiding Corin for a week.
"I am sorry, Your Grace."
Corin bowed slightly, the smile falling away from his face. "Good evening to you." Kyr grunted, and was about to walk away when Corin spoke again. He'd spent most of the day cooped up in the tower by himself, and was eager to talk to someone, anyone. And, being a teenage boy, he couldn't resist teasing his friend.
"Full moon tonight, Your Grace."
Kyr spun around, angry to be delayed in the cold by stupid small talk, when he had an idea.
"Yes," he agreed with a wicked smile. "It is a full moon. Corin, you've been here in the castle for a while now. Have you ever climbed the old bell tower on the night of a full moon?"
Corin looked up at the bell tower, part of the original fortress. It was no longer part of the outer wall, so no guards patrolled on top of it.
"No. Why? I've been up there in daylight."
"It's a tradition. Young royal men do it to prove they are brave. But don't worry about it. You're just a servant."
Kyr turned, as if to leave. Corin was hooked.
"I can do it. What's so scary about an old tower?"
Corin looked up at the stone spire. It wasn't even very tall, as towers go.
"The tower isn't scary. It's the full moon. When the enemy captured the castle, they were let inside by traitors, and one of the traitors killed the guards on top of that tower before they could warn of the attack. The ghosts of those guards still patrol that tower, and you can only see them in the light of a full moon.
Really?
Pedrus had never mentioned that there was anything special about the light of a full moon.
Really?
Carr said, as if he were a wizard himself. I've been up there. You can hear them and see them. Kaya felt butterflies in his stomach when he remembered being paralyzed by fear on the stairs of the tower. He had never actually gone all the way to the top of the tower in darkness, although he'd never admit that to anyone.
Of course, he said haughtily, I wasn't scared.
Corin, you don't have to do this.
And so, of course, Corin had to do it.
The steps that wound their way upward in the old bell tower were worn down in the center, so smooth they were almost slippery. This tower was even older than the tower where Pedrus lived. The windows were mere narrow slits, spaced wide apart. Corin had to feel his way, hugging the outside wall. When he reached what he thought was halfway up to the roof, he stopped. Was that voices he heard? He couldn't tell if it were voices or his imagination. He peered out the window slit. The moon had gone behind a cloud during his climb. It was now so dark he could barely see his hand in front of his face. Corin kept climbing, occasionally stumbling on an uneven step, until he saw an opening above him, dimly lit against the patchy clouds. The stone steps ended on a flat wooden floor. What Corin remembered from the one time he had been atop the tower, in full sunlight, was that the railing along the edge was rather low, so he inched forward until his foot touched the railing. He glanced down, where he could barely see Kaya in the shadows of the courtyard, looking up at the tower.
Ha! Corin said to himself. This was not such a big deal. Kaya had been playing a trick on him. There were no ghosts.
He waved down at Kaya, but the ducal heir couldn't see. It was too dark. Corin looked up at the clouds. If he waited a moment, the moon would be visible again, and he could prove to Kaya that he, Corin Bladewell, had climbed to the top of the tower by himself and was not afraid at all. Then the moon came out, illuminating the courtyard with a cold, silvery light. Corin was sure Kaya could see him. He stood at the railing, waving his arms, calling out in a loud whisper, Kaya! I'm up here! Kaya! Hey! I'm up at the... Corin suddenly became aware of voices behind him. Someone else had climbed up the tower behind him. He turned and...
saw ghosts.
They wore uniforms with the symbol of Tarador, and armor in an old style, and carried swords that glinted brightly in the moonlight.
Who goes there? The voices called, as the ghosts moved to surround him, reaching out to grab him.
He felt icy fingers on his arm, and he panicked. He later didn't remember bursting between the ghosts, evading their bony, outstretched fingers, leaping through the opening in the floor, tumbling down the first couple stairs, taking the rest three at a time, bouncing off the hard stone walls all the way down, until he stumbled through the doorway to sprawl at Kaya's feet in the courtyard. Kaya's eyes were as wide as Corin's. He had not expected Corin to actually reach the top of the tower.
Did you... Corin gasped between breaths. Did you see them?
Kaya nodded vigorously.
They were all around you. You shouldn't have been standing near the railing like that. When I...
Corin caught his breath.
Got to the top. There was nothing. It was dark. I didn't see them until the clouds went away. Where did they come from?
Kaya shuddered as if he could feel the icy hands of the ghosts on his skin.
They are always there. In the light of a full moon, the shadow realm becomes visible to us, here in the real world.
Kaer spoke as if he were a wizard himself.
Did they hurt you?
Corrin held up his arm, which still felt cold. He rolled up the sleeve and saw faint red marks where the ghosts had touched him.
No. It feels cold, but it doesn't hurt.
Kaer felt ill, as if he were going to faint.
Come on, let's get you in front of a fire, and something hot to drink.
That sounds good,
Corrin said, rubbing the marks on his arm to take away the chill. Suddenly, he looked up the full moon. The ghosts are always there.
Corrin's mouth dropped open. The shadow realm becomes visible in the light of a full moon.
I have to go.
He turned and ran as fast as he could toward the castle.
Wait, where are you going?
Kaer asked, startled. But Corrin had already disappeared around a corner. Corrin knew there was no way the royal guards were going to let him inside the palace at such a late hour, without an appointment. But the cornerstone chamber was not truly part of the palace itself, only attached to it. And so Corrin ran all the way around to the door of the corridor that led to the cornerstone chamber. The guards there nodded to Corrin and opened the door for him. Servants often used that corridor as a shortcut between parts of the palace and the kitchens. But when Corrin got to the chamber, the heavy doors were locked shut. He tried to look through the crack between the doors, and was frustrated to see only darkness. There were windows, set high up in the chamber wall, near the roof. He could look through those windows, if he could get up there. He turned around and raced back down the corridor, up two flights of stairs, and opened a window, careful not to let it squeak. Below the window was a roof, which led to the outside wall of the cornerstone chamber. If he could manage to crawl along the wall to a window, he could see inside the chamber. After his last experience, climbing out a window and onto a roof, when he very nearly fell to his death, Corrin was not eager to repeat the experience. He looked up at the moon. It was halfway down toward the horizon already, and clouds were building. He took a deep breath, and put his trembling right foot out the window onto the roof.
Corrin was about to yank open the door to the wizard's bedchamber when he realized that was a foolish idea. Phaedra set ward spells every night. If Corrin had yanked open the door, he might have set off howling banshees and been blasted back across the hallway. Ever since Kaer had warned Corrin that the wizard saw him as nothing but a servant, Corrin had been very careful around the powerful sorcerer. Perhaps he should forget about the cornerstone and let Phaedra sleep? No, this was too important. He used his fist to pound on the door.
Phaedrus! Lord Salva, please! You must come quickly!
The face that appeared when Phaedrus opened the door was that of an old man, befuddled by sleep, no more a wizard than Corrin was.
What time is... Corrin, what are you doing?
Phaedrus asked with a jaw-stretching yawn.
Please, sir, put on your robe. You must come quickly. The moon is setting, sir. Please, hurry.
It was a sleepy and grumpy Phaedrus who ordered the guard to unlock the door to the cornerstone chamber. The wizard half suspected his servant was playing a prank on him. Perhaps something Carlana had ordered.
Corrin, if this is a joke, it is most certainly not.
The wizard halted in mid-speech, gaping with his mouth wide open.
You see it? Oh, sir, you see it?
Corrin gasped in relief that the light of the full moon still shone through one window, down upon the cornerstone's resting place.
See what?
The guard asked, stepping into the chamber.
Nothing here but dust, Lord Salva. I think your servant is playing a trick on you.
No.
Pedras said in a harsh whisper. It is the enemy that has been playing a trick on us, on me, for centuries. And I have been a fool not to see the truth. Corin, how did you know?
Corin knelt down and ran a finger along the scrape marks on the floor.
When I realized these marks had been cut with a chisel, sir, I knew the enemy only wanted us to think they had dragged the cornerstone away. They must have sent the cornerstone into the Shadow Realm, like the way Lord Muazzo made that teapot disappear.
Cut by a chisel, Cut by a chisel.
Pedras roared with laughter.
Kings and queens have searched for the cornerstone, but only this boy thought about a common stone-cutting tool. And a teapot.
The guard edged back toward the door. The wizard had clearly gone mad.
Begging your pardon, Lord Sarva, but are you well?
Yes, yes, man. We are all well tonight. Corin, hold my hand, and concentrate on the cornerstone. Quickly, before the moonlight is gone.
Holding Corin's hand in a painfully tight grip, Pedras muttered words in a language Corin didn't understand, then shouted at the stone, and gestured with his staff. There was a blinding flash of light, and there, in front of them, was the cornerstone, where it had been all along.
May I touch it, sir?
Corin asked in awe, after Pedras released his hand. His body felt odd, and tingled all over.
Yes, but I think you should attend to our guard first. I'm afraid the poor fellow has fainted.
You do understand, Corin?
Pedras asked the next morning, when the wizard surprised his loyal servant by waking him up and bringing him a fresh pot of tea. Corin should have known this did not mean good news.
I guess so, Corin mumbled, staring at his shoes.
He had gone to bed, glowing with excitement from his triumph in the cornerstone chamber, dreaming of glory. But after Corin had gone to sleep, Kalana and Pedras had decided that credit for finding the cornerstone must go to Ariana, not to Corin. Everyone must believe that the Crown Princess had unraveled the legendary mystery. It would strengthen her hand in the future when dealing with the Dukes. For credit to go to a common servant when generations of royalty had failed to discover the truth would make the royal family a laughingstock. And Corin, after all, was nothing but a common-born servant. He didn't matter. He had saved a princess not once, but three times, and found the legendary cornerstone. What more did he have to do to be more than a servant boy? Or would nothing he ever did be good enough?
You know who really found the cornerstone, and I do, and Karlana and Ariana both know, Corin, but no one else can know.
The guard who fainted had been sworn to secrecy, and he was anyway not eager to talk about the events of that night. Pedras had agonized over, once again, denying Corin credit for a remarkable accomplishment. For saving Ariana's life, Corin should have, at the very least, been rewarded with a grant of land. And for finding the cornerstone, when wizards and kings had failed for countless years, why, a knighthood would be the barest minimum reward. Unfortunately, word that the cornerstone had been found would soon reach the enemy's ears. If the enemy heard a story that the Crown Princess had found the cornerstone, their assumption would be that the truth was her royal wizard had really been responsible, and the enemy would not inquire further. But if the enemy heard that the royal wizard's servant had found the cornerstone, then the enemy would look closely at this unknown servant boy, the same boy who, according to rumors, had saved the princess from the magic-spelled bear the enemy had sent to kill the girl. It would not take long for the enemy to discover there was something odd, very odd, and interesting about the wizard's remarkable servant boy.
Phaedrus could not allow the enemy's eye to be turned on Corin.
"It's not fair," Corin grumbled. "I know life isn't fair. Loyalty runs uphill," he said with a wink, "and the smelly stuff gets dumped on my head. Oh, what the hell. Now I can stop looking for the stupid thing."
"Phaedrus, why could I see the cornerstone, and the guard could not?"
Well, the wizard stumbled over his own tongue.
"You see, Corin, I think that living here, being around powerful magic all the time, you have become, well, rather sensitive to it. Nothing to worry about. Say, I hear the kitchen is baking cream cakes this morning."
Phaedrus hurried to change the subject.
"Why don't you bring us a plate of them, and we'll have our own celebration."
Corin was not the only person in the castle unhappy that he was not given credit for finding the cornerstone. Every time well-meaning people praised her for finding the cornerstone, Arianna felt like a complete fraud. Her mother had declared a feast to celebrate the discovery of the fabled cornerstone. Fortunately for Arianna, the feast was not to be for another 6 weeks, to allow time for the dukes and duchesses to travel to the castle. Perhaps by then her face would not burn with shame when people gushed over how clever she was. Arianna wanted to tell Corin that she didn't like stealing the credit for finding the cornerstone, but the very next morning after the unveiling of the cornerstone, having stuffed themselves with cream cakes, Phaedrus and Corin had ridden their horses out of the castle, and they weren't supposed to return for 5 whole days. Arianna was miserable, expecting that Corin might think it was her idea to steal the credit from him. Being out of the castle, riding about the countryside with Phaedrus and two of the royal guards, almost made Corin forget his disappointment over not being able to tell people that he had found the cornerstone. Almost. The purpose of riding out of the castle had been to give Corin's anger time to cool off. Gathering rare roots for potions had only been an excuse. It was difficult to find roots in the winter, even if a week of warmer weather had caused much of the snow to melt. Corin knew Phaedrus didn't need roots badly enough to roam around the countryside in winter, so he enjoyed simply being out of the castle, seeing something different than the grey stone walls. During the day, they rode along country lanes, Phaedrus mostly letting Corin decide where he wanted to go. In the late afternoons, they stopped at inns, where Phaedrus was given the finest room available, and the kitchen staff scurried around frantically to make a dinner good enough for the court wizard. What surprised and amused Corin was how the innkeepers and workers bowed and scraped to Corin, asking what his favorite foods were, helping him care for the horses, putting away the baggage, making sure he saw them taking special care setting up his own room. It was the first time in his life that people, especially adults, deferred to him. In the castle, Corin was just another servant. Out in the countryside, Corin was the person closest to the powerful master wizard, Lord Phaedrus Donsalva de la Murta, and because people were afraid to speak to the wizard, they spoke to Corin. A few people even offered him money, if Corin would ask the wizard for a favor. Corin always refused the money, of course, and also refused to ask favors from the wizard, whether paid or not. He didn't have to. When people heard a wizard was in the village, they flocked around the inn. Most people merely wanted to see the wizard, and the soldiers had to shoo people away to keep them from following the wizard all day, or he would get no peace at all. Some people wanted the wizard to bless them, or their fields, or their animals.
Pedrus gently explained that blessings were the province of priests, not wizards, and there was always a family in each village who wanted the wizard to heal a sick person. Sometimes Pedrus could help, and sadly, sometimes he could not. And sometimes he declared the sick person only had a bad cold and needed to rest, to be kept warm, and to drink a hearty chicken broth with vegetables. One morning, in a very small village up in the hills east of Linden, where the tiny inn had only two rooms, and Corin had to share a room with the two snoring soldiers, a man was waiting when they stepped outside after a surprisingly good breakfast. The man was wearing what must have been his best clothes, but he was clearly a poor farmer, with his clothes much patched, collar and cuffs frayed. When he saw the wizard, the man snatched his cap off and knelt on one knee.
"Please, my Lord Sava, my wife, she's with child, and she's sick, very sick. Could you please look at her, kind sir?"
Pedrus, who had slept well, having suffered no snoring companions in his room, and feeling good after a delicious breakfast served in front of a fire in the inn's cozy common room, took pity on the man, asking him questions about his wife. The man led the way, riding an old plough horse, several miles deeper into the hills, to a small but well-kept farmhouse at the end of the road. As they came around the bend in the road, Corin admired the man's property, a barn well banked against winter winds, with stacks of hay on the north side, healthy-looking animals grazing in the fenced paddock, rolling fields separated by lines of trees as wind breaks. The neat stacks of firewood, even now that winter was waning, were impressive, enough, surely, for another year. Right then, Corin knew his fondest dream was to have a farm just like this one. As they approached the house, the man called out, and two children ran out, a blonde-haired girl a few years younger than Corin, and a boy Corin guessed to be 6 years old.
"Papa, papa, come quickly, Mama is burning up with fever," the girl cried out, tears streaming down her face.
"Melissa, this here's the master wizard of all Tarador, show your respect," her father admonished his children.
The girl curtsied, and the boy bowed, avoiding looking the great powerful wizard in the eye. Pedrus feared he was too late, or could not help, when he entered the farmhouse and saw the woman. She was laying on top of the bed covers, and sweating, although the fire in the stove was low, and inside the house was cold enough the wizard could almost see his breath. She was also shivering, and when he felt her forehead, she was indeed burning up. First, Pedrus told her husband to stoke the fire to warm up the house. While her skin was hot, her insides were cold, Pedrus explained, hence the shivering. The wizard covered the woman with a blanket, knelt beside the bed, and made her drink water. He laid his hands on her, closed his eyes, and summoned his senses.
"Sir," Corin asked quietly, "what do you see, or feel?"
"A wizard can sense..."
Pedrus had been about to explain how a wizard could sense sickness inside a person or animal, sense something wrong and isolate it, and act upon it, and then strengthen the surrounding tissues. He'd been about to explain as a wizard to an apprentice, when he caught himself and remembered Corin was not yet an apprentice, that if he explained how to sense corruption inside a person's body, and how to send healing force flowing from wizard to patient, Corin may realize he, too, could sense that. And that might get Corin to thinking he, too, had wizardly power. That might make Corin realize his ability to calm frantic animals like Thunderbolt was, in fact, part of his power as a wizard. And for Corin to realize the truth now, too soon, would be a disaster. So, instead of explaining, Pedrus snapped,
Corin, stop bothering me when I'm working. Go boil some water and get me clean cloths.
Yes, sir. Sorry, sir, Corin mumbled, and hastened away to help the father bring in firewood. When the fire was roaring in the stove, and a pot of water was on the boil, Corin brought a bag of clean cloths and the wizard satchel of potions, then went out to help the two children with farm chores. Chores around the farm waited for no one. They did not care whether someone in the house was sick or even dying. He helped the girl get the family's two cows into the barn and milked one cow while she milked the other, and her little brother fed the goats and pigs. Then Corin tended the plough horse, bringing the animal into the barn, brushing its old coat, and bringing in a bale of hay.
"Sir, is Mama going to be all right?"
the girl asked, and Corin momentarily turned around to look for the wizard, for no one had ever called him Sir before. He was not much older than the girl, which certainly didn't merit him being called Sir, but he was a companion of the great and powerful wizard, and he now wore fine clothes, and he lived in a castle. To the girl he must seem like a grand figure.
"You don't have to call me Sir, miss. I lived on a farm like this before I came to serve the wizard."
"Really?"
the girl asked, wide-eyed.
"Really? I'm no one special, just a servant. I chop wood and fetch food and clean up after my master. As far as your mother, I don't know whether she will be well. But I do know that Lord Salva is the most powerful wizard in all the land, more powerful than you can know, more powerful than I could have imagined," Corin said with a shudder, as he thought of the staircase that didn't exist, and the disappearing teapots.
"So, if anyone can help your mother, he can. And if he can, he will. Lord Salva is a good man, which is why our enemy fears him so. Now, let's bring this milk to your father and see if the wizard needs anything." When they got back to the house, Corin at first feared the worst, for the mother was laying in bed with the blanket pulled up to her chin, and she appeared not to be moving. The wizard's face was drained of color. He and the father were huddled by the stove, heads nearly touching, talking quietly. The girl, seeing this, flung her arms around Corin and sobbed on his shoulder, while her little brother clung to his waist.
"No, don't cry, little ones," the father called out. "Your mother's going to be fine. And the baby, too. Lord Salva's worked a miracle on her—"
"No miracle," the wizard protested. "Merely a good dose of the right potion, and some help from a touch of magic."
From the wizard's tired eyes, the woman had needed more than just some help from magic. Healing her had been a strain on even his great powers. In his hand was a thick slice of bread slathered with butter and jam, for the use of magic had made him hungry again, as it always did. Corin noted the wizard's hand shook slightly.
"A fever has broken. Keep your wife warm, and let her rest. She needs rest and quiet, and fruit juice, if you have it, and a broth. Chicken broth is best, I find."
"Yes, my lord,"
the man replied, looking at the wizard worshipfully, which would have annoyed Pedrus.
"Apple cider I have, and we've a pot of chicken soup frozen in the shed. I'll heat it and give her spoonfuls, as you instructed."
A bit later, outside, the man tearfully offered to give Pedrus sacks of grain, or a goat, or even his prize cow, but the wizard refused.
"I don't know how else to thank you, Lord Salva," the man said, choking back tears.
"You don't owe me anything," the wizard insisted. "You pay your taxes. Your taxes help pay for my keep, and for the royal army that keeps the enemy from all our doors. My servant says you have an admirable farm, that you work hard and are a good steward of the land. Live a good life and take care of your family. That is all I ask."
In the end, Pedrus accepted a small jar of maple syrup,
mostly because he thought the man would feel better about having given something back to the wizard.
Now, Corin, we need to get on our way. I believe I saw a ruined castle on our way up this road, and I've never been in these hills before. I feel like exploring this morning.
Oh, yes, sir. Please, sir. I'd love to do that,
Corin said with genuine enthusiasm. He loved poking around old, tumbled-down castles, cities, and even just the foundations of long-ago farmsteads. It was now mid-morning, a sunny day warming up nicely, although the wizard warned cold and snow were on the way. Best to enjoy the good weather while it lasted, and be thankful that he would rest his head that night under the roof of an inn with a full belly. After they had ridden out onto the road, Corin asked,
"Do you feel up to a ride today, sir? We could go back to that inn for a meal."
"Yes, yes, I'm fine now, Corin. That was a good thing we did this morning, Corin," Pedrus declared.
And he did indeed look much better, with color returning to his face and his eyelids no longer drooping. Wizards did recover faster than ordinary people. Perhaps that was magic also.
"Although, lunch does sound good. I think the innkeeper mentioned he would have chops on the grill and potatoes later today. And I believe his wife was cutting up apples to bake a pie. So certainly we can't let that good woman's efforts go to waste, eh?"
the wizard said with a chuckle.
"We must go back down this road anyway, so we'll stop by that ruined keep."
The wizard looked up at the cloudless sky.
"This nice stretch of weather won't last past midday tomorrow, I fear. Best we start making our way back to Linden."
The wizard was right. The weather did turn foul, with clouds and cold and drizzle, with sleet falling at night. The day they returned to the castle, a wet snow fell, covering the roads and making the horses slip in the mud. Pedrus hurried from the stable up to his tower, telling Corin his old bones needed to get out of the cold. It took Corin 2 hours to get the horses groomed and fed and settled in their stalls, and the saddles cleaned and stored away. With the work done, Corin headed up to the royal kitchens with a gang of boys to see what they could find to eat. The boys were in a playful mood because of the unexpected early spring snowfall, laughing and joking, running around the weary Corin. When they came through the gate in the castle wall, a boy in front saw some of his friends on the other side of the courtyard, and with a shout, threw a snowball. The packed ball of wet snow arced high through the air toward the surprised boy, but it was Corin's friends who were most surprised. For while the snowball was in the air, Ariana came around the corner, and the intended target ducked out of the way. The snowball hit Ariana squarely in the chest, splattering her all over and soaking her dress. The Crown Princess sputtered, melting chunks of snow dripping down her face. There was a tense moment as the pair of royal guards in Ariana's party reached for their weapons, and Corin and his friends froze in horror. Assaulting royalty could get a person, even a young boy, thrown into the dungeon. Ariana held up one hand to stay her guards, while her other hand wiped the melting snow off her face. Without a word, she bent down to scoop snow from the courtyard and packed it into a ball.
"Charge!" she shouted. And the fight was on. Snowballs flew back and forth, and the fight raged, with the royal guard stepping aside and letting the children have fun. Soon everyone had been thoroughly smacked with snow. The ruckus attracted the attention of Carlana, who was walking down a corridor where windows overlooked the courtyard.
"Oh, dear, what a shame,"
one of the regent's maids exclaimed.
"That is no way for a young lady to—" "Oh, hush, Matilda,"
Carlana said with a wistful smile.
"She is young and growing up too fast. Let her be a girl for a while longer."
Down in the courtyard,
The two sides had moved closer, each side barely having time to pack the snow into balls before throwing. Corin took shelter behind a wagon. As he stood up to throw, he caught two well-aimed snowballs right in his face. He fell backwards onto the cobblestones. Ariana put her hands to her mouth in fear for Corin. Forgetting about the fight, she raced around the back of the wagon to see if Corin was injured, slipped in the snow, and fell right on top of him. Oof! Corin tried to catch his breath, with Ariana's knee digging into his stomach.
You're heavy! Oh, no! Did I hurt you?
Ariana cried in distress. When she had seen Corin across the courtyard, her only thought had been to run over to him and tell him it was terribly unfair that he was not getting proper credit for finding the cornerstone, and that it hadn't been her idea, and that someday she would be queen, and then she could see that he was recognized as a hero for saving her, and she was so sorry, and Corin's face was only inches from hers, and he looked so cute, with his mop of dark, curly hair falling across his eyes, and his face wet with melting snow, and his eyes sparkling. In the corridor above, Carlana saw that her daughter, the future queen, was laying on top of a commoner boy, and going to kiss him, right in the courtyard of the castle. Her maids also saw what was going to happen, and gasped in shock. Carlana's hands flew to the window, fingers fumbling with the handle to fling the window open. Ariana had never kissed a boy before, but it seemed so natural. She closed her eyes and shrieked in shock as Corin stuffed a handful of snow down the back of her dress. They both jumped to their feet, Corin laughing and grinning, Ariana hopping around, tugging on her dress as the cold slush dripped down her back.
Oh, you are the most rotten! Ha, I got you,
Corin laughed, dancing away as Ariana tried to tackle him. Up in the window, Carlana pressed a hand to her heart in relief. Matilda the maid observed knowingly,
"Girls at her age are interested in boys before the boys are ready."
"Yes. Still, I think you are right the first time. It is time that I treat my daughter as a young lady, instead of a girl."
The regent sighed.
"I wish she never had to grow up."
"Every mother wishes so, Your Highness."
Ariana gave up trying to catch Corin and rubbed her back up against the wagon to soothe her wet, frozen skin. Around them, the snowball fight had died down, with the combatants trying to wipe the snow off their own sodden clothes.
"Sorry about the snow,"
Corin said, regretting that he'd stuffed snow in her clothes. It had been an impulsive act that now seemed immature and stupid.
"Can I help?"
"No, I got it,"
Ariana laughed.
"Corin, I'm sorry about..."
She looked around her. People were too close for her to speak freely.
"About, you know."
Corin frowned, then shrugged, his mouth dry with nervousness at being so close to her, his stomach dancing with butterflies. "Pedris explained it to me. You're the Crown Princess. I'm a servant. Besides, it was your idea for us to look for, you know."
"Still, it's not fair."
"Life isn't fair," Corin said with a wink.
"People tell me that all the time."
So,
Ariana didn't know what to say. A moment before, she had been about to kiss Corin.
"How was your, where did you go?"
Corin scuffed his boots on cobblestones. Talking to Ariana was suddenly awkward, and he didn't know why.
"Oh, nowhere special. Digging roots for potions, and Pedris was healing people along the way. It was fun to be out of the castle for a while."
"Good.
That's good. Really good.
Your Highness, a guard asked.